This episode of The Gendernaut is brought to you by The Economist.
If the 20th century is the century where the women made changes, I think the 21st century will be the one where the men adapt to the changes that the women have made. And the lives of women will not change until the men come along. And they too need 50 years, like women have had, to rethink their role and their place and their identity at home and at work and in the society at large.
That's Esther Perel.
We're talking about what's next for men and how women can help on this episode of The Gendernaut, the podcast where we untangle the new masculinity and femininity. We're your hosts. I'm Nasrin Tavakoli-Farr, or Naz in short.
And I'm Jonathan Freeman. This week, Esther Perel talks to us about what's next for men and the role women can play in helping men redefine their own masculinity.
We need to be able to bring men into the perspective not of their power, but in fact of their insecurities. Not of their grandiosity, but of their shame, which is the hidden side. And that's very threatening to everybody, because that challenges a social order of how things have been set up for a long time.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to The Gendernaut. If you're new, this is a podcast where we take a dilemma around gender and we see if we can provide a little bit of clarity on it, maybe untangle and unpack the issues a bit, and maybe even come to some kind of a solution. So my name's Naz. I'm a journalist in London, and I'm joined by Jonathan, who is in DC. How's it going?
It's going great, actually, and I will tell you why. Most important thing, as we've discussed frequently, not so much on the podcast, is food.
Yeah.
And I just found the best taco truck.
Oh, wow.
And I feel bad for you guys in England, because you guys don't really do the taco Mexican thing.
Yeah, we have bad Mexican food, man. All the Americans complain about it. Like, where can I get a burrito? Like,
you know, it's funny enough, a friend of mine who's like a big, huge, he's actually a big, huge, like, private equity guy. His company actually owns a chain of restaurants in the UK, and he was so annoyed about the lack of Mexican food. He's from Texas, and he literally brought over and is starting a chain of Mexican restaurants.
Oh, nice. Do we get free food if we talk about it on the podcast?
You know, I'll let him. I'll ask him. I'll see him where he is on that, and we'll see if we can shamelessly promote. We could do a recording right from the restaurant.
No, stop. I'm getting hungry. So, tacos aside, this week we talked to Esther Perel, the super renowned therapist. She is the author of Mating in Captivity and The State of Affairs. She has a super famous TED Talk on rethinking infidelity. And she also hosts this wicked podcast called Where Do We Begin, which is basically couples therapy. So you sit in on a couple having therapy with Perel, and it's really incredible.
So Perel talks to us about what's next for men, how women have been defining their roles in society over the past 50 years. But she also talked about the future for men and how genders can better relate and communicate with each other, which I you know, is one of the highlights of what we talk about almost every week.
Yeah.
You know, and it certainly fits into kind of both themes for the season, because at the root of everything, you know, whether it's men in relationships, women in work, the bottom line is it's all about communication. And she really hits on that.
Yeah, so we have two big themes for this season. They are men and relationships and women and work. And that is because, Jonathan, you're looking for a wife and I am looking...
Naz, you're looking to take over the world.
Yeah. So before we hear from Esther Perel, we're going to have a quick note from our sponsor, The Economist.
Wait, we have a sponsor of The Economist? That's awesome. I love The Economist.
The Economist. It's not just about the economy or finance. This fine print publication has been covering a huge range of topics over the past 170 years. Politics, science, technology, the arts, and the environment. They've got it covered with expert analysis, helping you make the right decisions for, well, living, really. You see, I've been reading it for years, actually. I studied economics, and over the past decade and a half, I've been closely following a lot of their analysis about growing inequality and the rise of elites. They also recently had a fantastic review of the play Fatherland, which is showing here in London, and it's all about toxic masculinity. Now, the review ties the play into the Me Too movement, incels, and general violence that's taking place as a result of toxic masculinity. The Economist says, quote, "There is a creeping sense that something is profoundly wrong with the institution of masculinity, skewing men's perception of the lives they're expected to live. It is hurting women and children, and it is hurting men. Where is this toxicity coming from? How can it be stopped?" End quote. Now you can get a free print copy of The Economist by texting the promo code GENDER to the number 78070. That's G-E-N-D-E-R. Yes, as in the gender not. Text that over to 78070 to get your free print copy of The Economist. Once more, to get a smart guide to the forces that are changing our world, text GENDER to 78070 and get a free print copy of The Economist. Okay, so back to the gender knot. Here's Esther Perel.
I mean, it was already 3-4 years ago when people would say, what will be, you know, once you finish the infidelity project, do you have any? And I said, I want to work on the subject of men. I mean, this was way before the whole wave and movement that we are experiencing now. And people would say, but why? And I said, because I think that if the 20th century is the century where the women made changes, I think the 21st century will be the one where the men adapt to the changes that the women have made, and the lives of women will not change until the men come along. And they too need 50 years, like women have had, to rethink their role and their place and their identity at home and at work and in the society at large. And from that place, I became interested in the subject of modern masculinity. And over the years already, have often been one of the only women to enter into men's groups, men's workshops, where I witnessed kind of what happens when men can drop into a whole different level of interaction with each other, exposure to themselves, disclosure of themselves, when they can step outside of the male code, if you want. And I always found it enormously humbling. I felt so honored, because when women come to me in therapy and they share their pain, it is very moving, but I also know that they probably have already shared it with somebody else. Whereas when men come to me in therapy, for years now, I've been 35 years a therapist, this is not a new thought, I often know that they are talking to somebody for the first time, let alone that they're hearing themselves for the first time too.
Well, they might not even know what the issue is, right?
No, they often need a lot more prompting until they can articulate it. It's the creation of a vocabulary on the spot. You know, when men are in pain, they do it alone. And since they're meant to be needless and play through pain and be stoic and disconnected and autonomous and fearless and all of those things, it doesn't bode that well for how they address their relational life, which is what I focus on. But relational life is overall health. And ultimately, it's the quality of your relationships that determines the quality of your life. And yesterday, one of the things that came up in the talk was a concept that David Brooks, the journalist, had come up with, which I thought applied so well for men, is the difference between the eulogy and the CV. The resume, you know, of your performances is not the same as the eulogy, not of what you did, but of who you were.
Because I guess with men, it's very much achievement orientated, right? You kind of
yes,
show your
men
worth.
Are inculcated. Look, man up is not something you translate in the feminine. Neither is the word emasculated. Neither is the word loser. I mean, you prove your masculinity over and over again, and you prove it to other men. You know, it is a fragile identity that needs constant reinforcement, because if it was strong in its own, then you wouldn't have to prove it all the time. It would just be there. But it needs to constantly be reaffirmed and tested and proven. You know, there are not many cultures, if any, where you have to take the girls to the woods to help them transition from girl. Biology takes care of it, right, in a way. So that concept of this masculinity that constantly has to prove itself means that it has performance and achievement on one side, but it also has terrible threat of shame on the other. If you don't, all you have is shame.
Can women play a role in helping men find out who
absolutely,
they want to be?
Absolutely.
Or should women play a role?
Yes. I did another event this week that was based on a whole program on inequality and on gender gap and wage gap in particular in Silicon Valley and in Hollywood. And I thought the event was fantastic, but it was hundreds of women without men. And I thought, what a missed opportunity. It's not okay. It's just like, you know, I'm not sure men would voluntarily watch this program to begin with.
What was it called?
It's the Katie Couric series, America Inside Out. It's okay. Really good. But I know that if every woman there had brought in a male friend, a brother, a boyfriend, a husband, whoever, you know, it would have... Gender cannot just be a woman's concern. Mm-hmm. It's a human concern, and it affects all. I mean, patriarchy doesn't just hurt women. It hurts everybody. You know, that, to me, is very, very critical. And I think that, you know... If we want to help women have a voice and have a sense of power and agency and efficacy, and if we want to have men be able to be still powerful but also have an open heart and be connected to their emotions in a way that actually makes them more whole, then we create a true egalitarian system. And I think that's what I am working towards. The gay movement didn't just have gay people on the streets. It had everybody. The civil rights movement. I mean, once you understand that the well-being of others actually influences your own, that things are interdependent, the notion sometimes that you have these days that, you know, it's time for men to just shut up and listen. Yes, they do have a lot to listen to, absolutely. But so do women. And that means listening to men who speak differently and encouraging them to speak differently. Those men are our sons as well. They're not just some anonymous creatures. I have two boys, so we raise them. They don't just come out of nowhere. I do think that everybody needs to be part of the improvement of the other. I would say that this is true. It's a kind of a social welfare way of thinking about the world, and it is my conception.
So on this podcast, we're really keen to have men listening. And luckily, about half our audience is men, which is cool. But sometimes I wonder about how do we let men know that it's in their interest to tackle these issues? Because, you know, sometimes when you're the party who's discriminated against, it's kind of easier for you to explore your identity because the problem is so obvious to you. Whereas with a lot of men, I feel like the problems aren't even that obvious until it's women pointing them out to mm-hmm. them. So kind of how do we encourage men to take ownership right. of exploring their question. Masculinity?
So I have a few ways I would answer this thing. The same is happening for my podcast, Where mm-hmm. Should We Begin? It's a live couples therapy program. 45% of listeners are men. Mm-hmm. Listening to couples therapy, for God's sake. You know, I know that the TED Talks, I know that my books... are heavily listened to by men. There's something that is male-friendly in the way that I speak about things that I've known for the last 12, 15 years now. And to the point where there was a guy yesterday at the Wall Street Journal, literally flew in from the Philippines.
Oh, nice.
I mean, it was like, I said, for 45 minutes? He said, yes. And I just thought, you know, that'll move you. But... when people began to divorce, I grew up with only 3 children of divorce in my entire grade. They were different. Nobody talked about it. They didn't want to expose it. Sometimes people said you shouldn't go to play at their house because those are different families. You know, there's always a different family that could contaminate you with something if you stay. You know what I'm talking about. And I just thought it takes numbers. It takes numbers. Then I worked for 20 years with mixed couples, intercultural, interracial, interreligious families. Everybody said they can't succeed. They can't succeed. No, if you're the only one and you have to bear all the pressure of being the one, then it is much harder. But that doesn't mean that you didn't succeed because you were mixed. Maybe you didn't succeed because you were not supported. Mm-hmm. You know, let's not mix cause and effect. Same thing here. At the beginning, the men who listen are different. They're alone. And they need to know that they're not the only ones listening. So you try as best you can to connect them with each other in various ways that you do. I do it with live events. I do it with live webinars. I make it very clear you're not the only guy here in the village. You know, there's hundreds of you listening. And then it starts to feel less like, you know, I'm hiding this thing. You know, and then it becomes people, men who are able to go, and sometimes it requires being in groups of men that are unique today, and there are more and more of those. But sometimes it also, you know, are you a man who's actually ever heard one of your female friends describe an unpleasant experience that she's had? And I'm being nice when I say unpleasant, you know. No woman has ever come to tell me. That's one thing you hear these days a lot. You know, none of my female friends. I said, you know what? You're going to go ask. Find out. They haven't told you because ultimately they may still see you as a guy, you know. And who knows why? It's a bias. It doesn't mean you wouldn't. Go and ask. Then I make them go on an assignment. Be a journalist, you know. Ask five of your women friends or colleagues, you know, if they've ever had experiences at work, for example, you know. And just listen and just thank them for telling you. And then the next time you hear guys talk, you actually have something to answer. And you can say, you know, guys, let me tell you what also happens in our offices here. And it's this kind of step by step. My image for social change and for therapy in general is like playing pool. It's billiard. If you want to kick a ball, to go in the hole, it's never that ball that you need to kick. Which is the ball that you need to kick in order for the other one to actually go down? Mm-hmm. It's that strategic kind of thinking. So I think women are enormously important in the changing lives of men, the same way that men are important in the changing life of women. I mean, we are really interdependent. We need each other in so many spaces of life. I think that when, you know, it's very easy for women to talk about the misogyny of men. It's not so honest sometimes on the part of women to talk about their entire prejudices and what they consider masculine and how they actually play into the patriarchal model themselves. I mean, we either do it honestly and we all look at our double standards. And not only men have double standards, so do women. I was talking with one of the founders of one of the big apps, one of the three big ones. And, you know, I said, what kind of information? And the whole thing about height came up.
About height being more attractive?
Yes, of course. Of course. If you don't, you know, for every inch that you are shorter, you need to earn $40,000 more.
Wow.
You know, I said, how would women feel if they asked for weight?
Mm.
We would never stand for it. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody has a double standard of things that, you know, they think is more attractive. And the men are very much a part of that thing. I think it's much, women say all the time, I want to see these vulnerable men. Fair enough. I have worked with so many women, wives, mothers, who are terrified by the vulnerability of their men or sons. You know, because a vulnerable guy, my God, if he starts to tear, maybe he would collapse and he would never get up. You know, and then if he becomes so tender, then who's going to be my backup? Mm-hmm. You know, who am I going to lean against? I need a rock. I don't need a puddle.
So just on that point, something that comes up a lot and that we discuss on the podcast a lot is about emotional labor, that as women, we're kind of helping men with their emotional lives a lot. So you've made this great example of when men are vulnerable, sometimes women are freaked out by it. And I think there can be a problem whereby men don't take enough ownership for like how much work they also have to put into it, that it's like a two-way process, that like women can help you with your emotional life, but you also have to sort of take a step forward as well. And it's something I hear on your podcast a lot, when often, you know, a husband will have some problem and his wife will be so empathetic and supportive, and you almost feel like not only is she dealing with the problem in their relationship, but she's taking on so much of the emotional development that he has to do. And I think that can be a frustration where, as a woman, I mean, speaking for myself and a lot of women I know, yeah, we want to help men, but how do we do it in a way whereby they also take ownership so we're not doing the work for them?
Right. But I think that it's a little more layered than that. Mm-hmm. I think that when a woman starts to talk for her guy, a part of it is because she thinks that she has to. And a part of it is because she doesn't think he would do it as well as her. And a part of it is because he is used to letting her do it because he also has internalized that it wouldn't be up to her standard. And a part of it is because he thinks she just does it faster. And a part of it has let her be the representative of that dimension of life. And so it's a lot of internalized biases, if you want.
So should women step back and be like, no, you know, is there encouragement for the men to come forward?
You know, it's like sometimes I hear the guys come into my office and say, I'm not a talker. And then they sit down and I
talk
20 minutes straight. 20 minutes straight. And they still tell me I'm not a talker. After that. And I look at them and I say, no, absolutely not. You know, we shall let the behavior and the identity have nothing to do with each other. You know, then I say to her, you know, which part of him do you believe? The part of him that is a talker and knows to express himself so elegantly and eloquently, or the part of him that still wants to hold on to the masculine code that, you know, he is not one? Which one do you live with? And which one do you relate to? See, I think there is always the overt and the covert. Mm-hmm. And there is a part of women that we just have to say, you know, you want more from him, right? Sit back and watch. Enjoy the show, as they say, you know, enjoy the flight and let him do the work. But women have a mixed relationship. They want him to do it. They don't believe he can do it. They're angry at having to do it. They're afraid of what will happen if he does it. It's a combination of things. It's not one thing only. And it is not an individual plot. This is socialization. This is historical. This is legacies of mothers and grandmothers having talked to their daughters. You know, it's multiple layers. And they resent having to do it, but they don't believe that he could do it or that he really wants to do it or that he's doing it for the right reasons or that he's doing it because it matters to her and she wants it to matter to him. There's a lot of things going on in the emotional layering between the genders.
So this is an interesting example because I've had this happen in the past few months because of Me Too and all these conversations that are happening. So I've had this happen with male friends where I've been trying not to do what you say, like speak for them too much and stuff, and kind of try to let them deal with it on their own. And in some ways, I feel a little bit guilty doing that because still men are finding it hard to have those conversations with each other. So kind of how do you make that balance as a woman of being supportive for the men, but like you say, not sort of invading the territory or kind of speaking on their behalf or, you know, taking over?
You know, I've led a number of conversations in the last few months inspired by the changes of the moment. And I call them sex, power and gender. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily only focus on Me Too. I really focus on a kind of reckoning that is happening with one of the oldest power exchange systems. And one of the oldest power exchange systems is that forever, men traded social power for sex, which they otherwise would not have access to. And women traded beauty and youth for social power, which would otherwise be denied to them. This is the old trade show. That trade show is now being challenged. For that, we need to be able to bring men into the perspective not of their power, but in fact of their insecurities. Not of their grandiosity, but of their shame, which is the hidden side. And that's very threatening to everybody because that challenges a social order of how things have been set up for a long time. That you don't undo on the spot. Mm-hmm. I do fishbowls in those conversations. They can be 80 people or 1,000 people. And in the fishbowl, the men talk for a while alone, only to themselves, while the women listen. And then the women talk to themselves while the men listen. It is beyond powerful. But what's very interesting is the relationships of the women's listening to the men talking like this. They've never talked about it like that to each other, to themselves. The stuff that comes out is just the men. It's mind-blowing, you know. The women too. The women too. The men have never heard the women talk like this. Everybody has protected the other group in some warped way. I use the word protection, you know, as in you can't understand. If I, you know, that is a fundamental contempt. You won't get it. So what's the point of telling you?
But sometimes there can be a fairness to that. Like someone has tried to tell the other party and they've been shut down.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. I mean, people come to this. There's a reason that it became this way. I'm not at all... I'm establishing it. I'm not even justifying it or criticizing. I'm establishing this. This is the data of the moment. From there, we start to do the work. That's where each group starts. And you take them where they are at. So on the part of men, it's the ability to listen to the pain of the women without a feeling instant flooding of shame or that they need to fix it. That they have to do something, getting defensive, minimizing it, qualifying it, semi-blaming her. All of those maneuvers that are so common because it's so difficult to listen. Because it's so difficult to listen without feeling instantly individually accused. You know, I'm not one of those. What are you putting that on me? The whole thing. And women, when they listen to the men talk from that other place, I think the two things that are really important is not to first say that's not enough. I expect more openness, more vulnerability, more. Like it's not enough. Like it right away is not good enough, you know. And one of the women began with that response in one of the groups. It's like I said, what did you hear? And she gets up and she says, what I didn't hear. And I said, let me stop you right there. Because here's what's going to happen. If you do this, A, you're going to make it feel possible. What's the point of talking? It doesn't matter what I say. You're always going to tell me what's off.
It's not good enough.
Why don't you just tell me what you want me to say? Put the words in my mouth and I'll just repeat them. Maybe then you'll be happy. That's the voice of contempt, right? And three is I'm going to withdraw and be silent again because this was so hard and I don't think you have a clue of how hard it was. So what you're looking at is all the systems, the conspiracies where each group induces silence in the other. Everybody has an interest sometimes in keeping things under wrap. Then it festers, then it explodes, you know, it has to erupt somehow. And that's the part that I work on, is in how do you take away the silence, create something that is not shrouded in secrecy and in shame, provide a different quality of listening, respectfully, with dignity, with integrity, that isn't Pollyannish, that doesn't, you know, pretend, oh, we're going to be in a beautiful world right now. We're not. Never were. But that says things will change.
If you had to give advice to women for the one thing they could do to help men as they redefine their masculinity, what would that be?
To mothers, I would say, watch out when you stop touching your sons as much as you touch your daughters. Watch out, fathers, when you tell your boys, don't cry. Because at age 3, boys and girls do exactly the same. Watch out when you talk about boys manning up or, you know, proving their masculinity and it means stripping them from their emotionality and their connections to others. To teachers, let boys and girls have friendships from the earliest ages. It is one of the most powerful systems for learning about the other, for normalizing the other, from looking what goes on in the backstage of the other on the other side. Let boys and girls grow up together. But in friendships, it's not just that they share the classroom, in friendships. To women, if you need to help your partner in some of the development of the emotional language, don't think of it as I shouldn't have to do this. Do it yourself. It's in your best interest. It's in your best interest. Like all partners who say to the other, you do it. You know, think about what you want. And if it involves your being part of it, why would you not? You know, just in the name of a principle.
Because then you end up doing it all. I think that's the worry a lot of women have. They end up having to do most of the work.
But you do that. You will do
you
much.
Do anyway.
You will do most in any case. So at least do it in a way that is more self-serving. Mm-hmm. It's not sacrificial, you know. It's I think that notion, you know, women sometimes do all the work, and in the West, women sometimes still think that they do some work better. You know, I think that if you're going to talk about equality at work, you need to talk about equality at home. And that does require us accepting that we are not the standard and that we don't own parenthood.
That was Esther Perel talking about what's next for men and how women can best help men.
Okay, so that was quite a heavy interview. First of all, what was really interesting is somewhere at the start she said about how, like, men often, the first time they're telling me something is the first time they've ever told anyone. And that was interesting because it was like, most of my life only my shrink knows about. So I was like, ooh, that was really interesting hearing that from her, because I was like,
sure.
There's so much stuff that only my shrink knows about. Anyway, but aside from that, it brought up all these emotions, because the second half, she talks about the conspiracy of silence and the ways in which men and women induce silence in the other party. And it just brought up all these times when I was thinking of, like, times when I had expected more from some guy and he clearly couldn't handle it, and maybe that was really unfair on him. Times when I was trying to speak and a friend of mine was just minimizing the problem and I just felt unheard, and all I wanted was for them to say, like, I'm really sorry, that's shit, instead of them, like, trying to explain it to me and trying to, like, minimize it. It just brought up so many dynamics, and it kind of just made me think, wow, there is, like, so much work on both sides.
One of the things that struck me in terms about the conspiracy of silence was also about what she had said earlier, which was talking about, like, the fragility of masculinity and how, you know, like, men have to continually reaffirm masculinity. But yeah. She made one comment. There was one moment that I actually really actively disagreed with her about, which was she talked about how it's, you know, you're reaffirming masculinity to other men. But I actually really think it's also to very much to women. And that women mm-hmm. have a very key and critical role. Like, women also say to men, you know, man up. I need you to man up, you know, kind of thing.
Right.
And use that language of, you know, what I think we could all agree is, like, not necessarily bringing out the best in men and sort of reinforcing some of these less ideal gendered constructs. And in terms of kind of, like, how women can best help men, I think women can't reinforce that kind of concept, you know.
Well, this is the thing, because I've had this happen with not in relationships, with a couple of my male friends, where they've acted so immature, and I don't think I've ever said to them, like, you know, become an adult, man up, but, like, I've really wanted to. And in a way, I don't know, in a way, isn't that inspiring for someone to be like, you know, step up? I mean, if you say it in the right way, but...
Yeah, no, I mean...
I've had other men say to me, like, that friend of yours, he just needs to, like, man up. He needs to get it together. There's something about being too gentle with the other side that I'm not a fan of.
But there's a difference between... But there's a difference between, like, this concept of stepping up, being an adult, versus, you know, manning up, grabbing a pear, you know, like, the sort of gendered kind of... You know, it elicits in me, at least, a very different kind of feel. Like, the stepping up, like, the difference of the language, like, that linguistic difference, like, the stepping up, I need you to step up here, and I need you to, like, that to me sort of speaks to what you've often referenced on the podcast, like, are the parts of masculinity that you, you know, think well of, and sort of that, you know, like, the integrity in terms of being able to, you know, utilize strength and pushing back on something. You know, that to me sort of is elicited out of the stepping up or adulting kind of construct, whereas, like, manning up, you know, like, I usually, like, the first thing I think of is, like, somebody, we're about to get into a fight, you know, like, and, right. You know, and probably a physical one.
If there's a situation and a woman who's important in a man's life, if she wants to tell the man that justifiably he needs to step up and he needs to take responsibility, be a bit more accountable, which is very, and often it's very much in her rights to tell someone this, what phrase should she use? Like, dude, I need you to step up. Is that more effective than?
Yes.
You need to man up?
Yeah, I think step up is a lot more, because again, you're calling on the best instincts necessarily. You know,
so you're not undermining their manhood by saying, I need you to step up, whereas man up kind of implies they might not be a man.
I think using the phrase man up, you know, can elicit additional crap that may not be intended, whereas step up, you know, strikes me as more of a moment of integrity. I mean, we might be quibbling over hairs, or as we say sometimes at work, you know, we're trying to change happy to glad.
Yeah, but these distinctions are important.
I agree, but I'm saying, like, on an emotive scale, I would say, like, the stepping up is sort of eliciting the positive sides of what you're trying to get at, versus the man up could bring up other things that is not necessarily what you're looking for. So knowing how much you enjoy the word vulnerable, I thought it was really interesting about what she was talking about in terms of women needing more from men. And it was very interesting because I literally just went through this over the past couple days, where one of my very closest female friends, you know, we've sort of been having a conversation over months. This is by no means a romantic partner, but somebody who is near and dear to my heart. You know, she was explaining to me and expressing to me like kind of how she needed me to step up in a very direct way and what she was needing from me. And, you know, I said, you know, and I was explaining to her, I said, listen, you know, I did not know what to say in that juncture. So I said nothing. And I didn't know if saying the wrong thing was going to exacerbate an already very delicate situation. And, you know, so I made an active decision to say nothing. It's not because I didn't care, you know, and as we sort of hashed it out and kind of discussed through it, I think a lot of women, and again, I don't, in this regard, I very much don't want to speak for all men, but I think many times women do believe that silence denotes a lack of care or a lack of empathy. And I think a lot of times, a number of times, certainly for me, and I think for other men, though I'd have to actually, you know, solicit some conversations on this, a lot of times I just don't know what to say. And I don't want to create a bigger problem, not because I'm fearful of it, but because, you know, somebody's been extraordinarily vulnerable with me in a very deep way. And I want to be able to respect that. And I want to be able to, you know, so, and maybe this also references back to kind of like her whole conspiracy of silence. And this is part of that problem.
No, that's a really interesting point, because I feel like I've been in the scenario you're talking about a lot. And so it's interesting because Perel was saying about, like, with women, that, you know, often what happens is that they're angry that, you know, they want more from the men. And these are all the things he didn't say. It's interesting because, like, when you talk about the silence, and I'm only speaking for myself here, but I'd think a lot of women I know agree. Yeah, it does come across like there isn't a caring. And what's wrong with saying, I've heard you, I don't know what to say, but I hear you. I'm sorry that you're hurt, or something.
And
you know?
And maybe it's something. Maybe something that simple is just like is that I've heard you. I intellectually understand. I need to process this. And I think though our instinct is less is more.
Don't address it.
It's not necessarily an avoidance, but it's like, did I literally just step into, you know, into a pile of tinder? And is the something that I am going to say, and we're not talking about swiping right here, kids. Is the one thing I'm going to say going to be that spark that makes all of this go very bad? Not necessarily for me, but for her.
So I have a very good friend of mine who has been on this podcast. And I think one of the most important things with he and I is that we say our stuff and we are able to apologize. So like, I remember a few years ago, something very sensitive happened and he was really insensitive and it really hurt my feelings. And, you know, about 3 days later, he called me and he's like, I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to do that. I just don't understand the situation, but I really didn't mean to hurt your feelings. And that was okay for me. And I really appreciated that. Like, it's okay to say that you don't understand something, but you're sorry and you're there. Whereas like just like walking away and not addressing it, which is something else I've dealt with several guys, that is basically saying I can't be bothered to deal with it. Or, and this is where it gets quite heavy, with some of them, I don't even think it's that they can't be bothered to deal with it. They just don't know how, and that's just way too much of a leap. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no.
I kind of wonder if that can be the problem. Sometimes I've had situations with guys, and again, in all different contexts, where I've kind of come to the realization, and this is maybe quite harsh to say, but my realization is that this person is so not up to having a conversation that our entire communication needs to end, because like we can't, like they are so far from a conversation. It's not a case of like they need me to explain something and they can think about it for a few weeks. That like they need a few years of therapy before we can actually be in a state to have this conversation, which is why when Perel was talking about like women trying to speak for their men, trying to, you know, I wonder if often with women there's this fear that this guy is so not there, you know?
Yeah.
That you don't even want to look at that possibility because it's like quite overwhelming.
You heard from Esther Perel on What's Next for Men.
It was hosted by me. I'm Naz Jantavakoli-Farr, or Naz in short.
And it was hosted by me. I'm Jonathan Freeman. Our fantastic co-producers are Sam Baker and Jonathan Blackwell.
We'll be back next week. Bye for now.
Talk to you later.